KBOO.org/evening news. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov, and I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the past week or so. Here are some of the news items I'll be covering. The unending humanitarian crisis in Haiti. Promises on aid to the global south. And genocide in Nagorno-Karabakh. The unending humanitarian crisis in Haiti. The violence in Haiti gets progressively worse. Gangs are said to control 80% of Port-au-Prince, the capital, where they pillage, rape, and execute those who oppose them. Citizen vigilante groups have added to the violence, killing gang members in retribution. Now Kenya may become the first African leader of a UN peacekeeping group, though Kenya has a poor reputation in that role. In any case, Kenya would only send about 1,000 soldiers, far too few to quell the large-scale violence. Haiti is essentially a failed state, with a government in disarray, police unable to contain, much less stop the violence, around 200,000 people displaced, and very high rates of poverty and unemployment. The August 2021 earthquake added measurably to the humanitarian crisis. As Mercy Corps is reporting, quote, "The overall situation in Haiti is catastrophic. Today, an estimated 5.2 million people, or close to half the entire population, requires humanitarian assistance, including almost 3 million children." Promises on aid to the global south. The Biden administration is trying to take advantage of China's economic problems and Xi Jinping's failure to attend the G20 meetings in India. But that's easier said than done. For one thing, promises of economic development assistance to developing countries require support from Congress. Biden is promising billions in aid with the clear intention to woo countries away from China's Belt and Road Initiative. But sentiment in Congress isn't all that supportive. Nor is it certain that other countries that made lavish promises at the G20 summit will come through. They agreed to greatly increase funding of global development banks, including the World Bank and the new BRICS Bank, to devote more money to biofuels for developing countries, and to run oil and gas pipelines from the Persian Gulf to nearby countries, including India and Israel. But the magnitude of need, especially in Africa, far outpaces these steps, even if implemented someday. Larry Summers, the former U.S. Treasury Secretary, was co-chair of an expert group that fashioned the plan I just mentioned for greater funding of global banks. Separately, he authored a Washington Post op-ed that pushed for funding commitments in very low-interest loans and major grants, far beyond those just agreed upon in India. As Summers observes, debt and rising interest rates are destroying developing country economies and turning them away from liberal politics. He's especially concerned about Africa, where he says external finance has dried up, interest rates on loans have skyrocketed, and most countries are deep in debt, quote, forcing their governments to choose between servicing debt, investing in their people, or protecting the planet, unquote. Yet Africa has enormous potential in critical areas, such as solar power, rainforest absorption of carbon, and minerals vital to energy-saving technologies. Two items the G20 did not make progress on, peace in Ukraine and climate change. Vladimir Putin did not attend the meetings. The final document from the summit spoke in the usual diplomatic way about the war, saying, quote, "all states must refrain from the threat or use of force to seek territorial acquisition," unquote. Interestingly, Larry Summers' recommendation in his op-ed that Russia's $300 billion in frozen assets be used to rebuild Ukraine got no attention at the New Delhi summit. Genocide in Nagorno-Karabakh. Nagorno-Karabakh is an Armenian-speaking enclave surrounded by the state of Azerbaijan, which is mainly Muslim. It's been the scene of on-again, off-again fighting for decades. In terms of sovereignty, it's generally agreed that Nagorno-Karabakh belongs to Azerbaijan, but Azerbaijan's attempts to forcibly bring about integration amount to ethnic cleansing. Recently, Azerbaijan has blockaded the only supply route into Nagorno-Karabakh in an attempt to starve the population, in defiance of an order in January from the International Court of Justice. Nicholas Kristof of the New York Times reports, quote, "The former chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, whom I got to know years ago when he sought accountability for the genocide in Sudan's Darfur region, now describes what is happening in Nagorno-Karabakh in a similar fashion. There is an ongoing genocide, he says, against 120,000 Armenians living in Nagorno-Karabakh. We tend to think of genocide as the slaughter of an ethnic group, but the legal definition in the 1948 Genocide Convention is broader and doesn't require mass killing so long as there are certain, quote, acts committed with intent to destroy a particular ethnic, racial, or religious group. It's the same broader definition that applies to China's repression in Xinjiang, a genocide. In 2020, Russia brokered a peace agreement after some 6,500 people died in several weeks of fighting. By then, Azerbaijan had seized a good deal of Nagorno-Karabakh's territory. The agreement did not hold, and now, with the tension of interested parties focused on the war in Ukraine, the population of Nagorno-Karabakh is threatened with extinction. In other news, two stories of how globalization impacts U.S.-China trade relations. One such impact comes from the new 5G Chinese smartphone by Huawei. It has an advanced chip designed and manufactured in China in response to U.S. efforts to prevent China from acquiring that technology, including from U.S. allies. Paul Triolo, the technology expert at Albright Stonebridge Group, calls the new phone, quote, a major blow to all of Huawei's former technology suppliers, mostly U.S. companies. The major geopolitical significance, he says, has been to show that it's possible to completely design without U.S. technology and still produce a product that may not be quite as good as cutting-edge Western models, but is still quite capable, unquote. The Huawei story suggests that U.S. control on semiconductor technology exports to China may not work as planned. The cost to China of building a comparable semiconductor industry will be very high, but economic globalization plus Chinese ingenuity are likely to succeed in the end. How will that affect U.S. sanctions on China? Chris Miller, author of Chip War, says, quote, "This shows that Chinese companies like Huawei still have plenty of capability to innovate. I think it will also probably intensify debate in Washington on whether restrictions are to be tightened," quote. Most likely tightened rather than loosened. The other side of the coin, U.S. efforts to limit reliance on imports of Chinese goods, also contains a surprise. A new study finds that, try as they might, U.S. importers are still buying from China, just not directly so. As the New York Times reports, though imports from China dropped significantly between 2017 and 2022, quote, places like Vietnam gained ground, supplying the U.S. with more apparel and textiles, while neighbors like Mexico began sending more car parts, glass, iron, and steel. What's more, it's Chinese factories in those countries that are producing these goods. It's the global supply chain at work. And the economies that are benefiting most are those that specialize in products China would normally export directly to the U.S. But there is a cost, higher prices for consumers, as the supply chain lengthens. Protests in Syria. The 12-year-old civil war in Syria is largely confined to the north and east of the country, but public protests have died out, until now. The brutal rule of President Bashar al-Assad is the focal point of the protests, triggered by the government's ending of subsidies on gasoline. The editor of a local newspaper says, quote, "This was the spark for the uprising, but people came out into the streets not calling for this decision to be reversed. They came out into the street to call for the fall of the regime because they realized that the situation won't change without a change in the political situation," unquote. Syria's economy is in terrible shape. As the Times reports, about 90% of Syrians are living below the poverty line, and about 70%, 15.3 million people, need humanitarian assistance, according to the UN. Past protests against Al-Assad's rule sputtered out, but this one is said to be different because of support from religious leaders, such as in the Druze minority. So far, Syrian security forces have not rounded people up as they have in the larger cities. But that may be just a matter of time if the protests gain steam and start to resemble the Arab Spring protests of 2011. That's when the Syrian civil war began. Political paralysis in Spain. Despite administering a decisive defeat to a far-right party in recent parliamentary elections, the Spanish electorate wound up with a stalemate between the ruling party and the main opposition. As sometimes happens in a parliamentary system, a coalition of larger and smaller parties needs to be formed in order to assume the leadership. In Spain's case, the minority party most likely to need wooing is the longtime supporter of Catalan independence, a position anathema to virtually all the other parties. Will Slovakia turn against the war? Up to now, Slovakia has been a consistent supporter of Ukraine's defense against Russia. But Slovakia's president faces a general election September 30th, and polls show him trailing badly behind a pro-Russia populist. Slovakia, a country with only 6 million population, is a NATO member, but the pro-Russia candidate is denouncing NATO and vowing to end military support of Ukraine, meaning air defense missiles and fighter jets. More importantly, it would be a breach in the otherwise consistent NATO and European Union support of Ukraine, excepting only Hungary. Opinion polls show that a majority of Slovaks believe NATO and Ukraine, not Russia, are responsible for the war. Climate change targets farmers in Europe. It's unfair, many European farmers are shouting, dairy farmers in particular, since their cows are producing far too much nitrogen, nearly half of what their countries produce. They are being urged to cut herds or find some other business, which naturally rankles farmers who in past years have been the pride of their countries for the exceptional products they produce. But governments are getting serious about climate change and are looking for less harmful ways to produce milk and cheese. Thus, a difficult problem, and one that some farmers are dealing with by turning to far-right politicians for support. Borrowing, it would seem, from U.S. politics, these politicians are framing the pressure on farmers as an offshoot of woke culture, environmentalists gone wild who don't care about rural people. Israel's search for compromise. Israel's judicial reforms, pushed by the far right and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, remain up in the air. Israel's Knesset, or parliament members, are in constant battle over whether or not to bargain. The most important issue is reasonableness. Should the Supreme Court have the power to consider cases based on a reasonable concept of judicial independence? Most crucially, should the court have the power to rule on the judicial reforms themselves, which, if implemented, would curtail its own power? Quite a mess. Reportedly, Netanyahu wants some kind of resolution, even an agreement by the ruling and opposition parties to do nothing, so that he has something to show President Biden when they meet later this month in Washington. But the reality is that ruling far-right parties are against any compromise, and opposition parties either insist on scuttling the main features of the judicial reform or are calling for Netanyahu's resignation. One of the few points of agreement among politicians of all stripes is that Netanyahu can't be trusted. President Isaac Herzog remains the one key political leader who is desperately seeking a compromise deal. He's been working across the aisles for months now, but only a handful of parliament members seem to be listening. Russia punishes a Nobel Prize winner. The Putin regime finds various ways to suppress ordinary dissenters and especially famous ones. I've previously discussed the long prison terms given Alexei Navalny. The latest victim is Dmitry Muratov, editor-in-chief of the newspaper Novaya Gazeta and winner of the 2021 Nobel Peace Prize. When he received money from abroad and put his Nobel Medal up for auction, he was labeled a foreign agent. Then he donated the money to Ukrainian refugee children. Muratov closed his paper in protest of the war. Other journalists restarted it under a new name, based in Latvia. Being a foreign agent or an undesirable person makes one persona non grata in Russia these days. Finally, Kim Jong-un travels to Russia. Kim has arrived in Vladivostok for his first trip outside North Korea in 4 years. As usual, he'll be traveling by train in style, though not very fast, since his heavily armored trains, carrying a huge entourage along with cars and fine wine, has a top speed of about 55. The purpose of Kim's trip is supposedly to sell Putin more weapons, a reversal of the usual weapons transaction between them. Kim must feel great pride at having Putin as a supplicant. That's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks very much for listening. Take good care.
KABU News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KABU News In Depth. A new paper from the Institute for New Economic Thinking is entitled The Horizontal Merger Efficiency Fallacy. It argues that a distorted definition of efficiency has allowed big business interests to accumulate more and more power, and has been damaging for society as a whole. Gabriel Lozada is an associate professor of economics at the University of Utah and the co-author of the paper. He spoke with KABU contributor David Rosenberg, who began by asking him to contrast the business person's definition of efficiency with what economists call Pareto efficiency.
So the economist's idea has nothing to do with costs per se. It has to do with the welfare of different individuals in society and whether or not you're in a situation where you really ought to move to something else because you could be making some people better off without hurting anyone else. Now, the next question is there some connection between the economist's notion of Pareto efficiency and the business person's definition of efficiency as minimizing cost? There is a connection, but only in a highly unlikely world where all firms are small. No firms have any market power. There are no economic agents which have market power. There are no asymmetries of information. In that kind of perfect world, firms minimizing their costs would be a good thing and would help society actually achieve Pareto efficiency. But that's not the world we live in. And so in the world we live in, there's really no connection between the business person's idea of lowering their costs and the economist's idea of Pareto efficiency.
But then you have these market-oriented economists, the Chicago School, those kind of people saying that what? That it is efficiency to orient your policies toward the market rather than government spending, let's say.
Right, and this is particularly prevalent in the field of law and economics when the discussion turns to antitrust, where the economists or economic consultants that want to support a merger, a proposed merger, will often say that with this merger will come, what I would say, will come cost reductions, but what they say is will come efficiencies. And if they were to use the correct term, which is cost reductions, then it would be clear that, yes, a cost reduction is good for the firm, but it's not necessarily good for society. The firm's costs are someone else's income. And so it's not immediately obvious that reducing someone's income is automatically a good thing. It might be, but that requires some analysis. However, if we use the word, or if we're forced to use the word efficiency instead of cost minimization, then it becomes now very hard to try to take a position that we're against efficiency, because efficiency has this aura of being something that's always good. And so by substituting efficiency for what they really mean, which is cost minimization, they make it impossible to raise important questions about whether this is a good thing or a bad thing.
Well, they'll often say that it's better for the consumer, just like they say about free trade agreements.
That's right. And it's very prevalent in economics to only analyze what in the law and economics field is called consumer welfare, and to hence analyze the market for outputs, where one side of the market is consumers, the other side is producers, and you look at the welfare of consumers. But there are also input markets, like the market for labor, and the welfare of the input suppliers, such as the workers, is just as important as the welfare of consumers. Yet input markets are often completely ignored in these analyses, which is a simple error.
Where does deregulation come in? When you speak about mergers and antitrust, are you talking also about deregulation, or would that be a broader category?
I think actually it's not so much a broader category. These days, we don't have a lot of regulation in the economy other than antitrust. Well, maybe I shouldn't quite say that. That's going a bit too far.
I mean, wasn't that what started under the Carter administration, more deregulation, and followed up by Reagan, more and more industries being deregulated?
Absolutely. So first you had Carter, who was a Democrat, deregulating, if I recall correctly, airlines.
Trucking, I think also. Yeah.
And considering other industries. And then the Reagan administration followed it. So indeed, starting in the 1970s, there was this notion that government regulation is bad. I don't think that was well thought out. Government regulation certainly sometimes can be a bad thing, but a completely unregulated industry can also sometimes be a bad thing. And there have been some studies in European countries of state-owned enterprises or enterprises that are under strict regulation, and they actually seem to work fairly well. So
you can have real disasters when you start to deregulate, right? I mean, we saw that with the financial crisis, you know, when you allow these Wall Street guys to do whatever they want, essentially, and create new financial instruments that very few people understand. Aren't you asking for trouble there?
What tends to happen, it seems, and this is a combination of politics and economics, is that if you have successful regulation for many decades, people perceive that the financial system is quite stable, which is true, but eventually forget the reason why the financial system is very stable, the reason being regulation. So then people begin to think, well, if we didn't have this regulation, then there's all this other kind of financial things that we could do. And since the financial system is stable, we don't really have to worry about stability. So let's lobby the government to get rid of the regulations so that we can do these exciting new things.
Unleash the creativity of the American people, as Reagan might say. But then, has the pendulum swung back the other way? Maybe not.
I think not enough. We haven't reimposed the Glass-Steagall Act, which separated commercial banking and investment banking. Some people have talked about that. I think Senator Sanders has talked about that. Perhaps Senator Warren, I'm not quite so sure, but we haven't done that. So people tend to, over decades, forget the purpose of regulation and then have to learn the hard way that, oh, actually, maybe the old regulations and the old ways of doing things weren't merely old-fashioned, but were actually pretty smart.
Other than the two senators you mentioned, do you see any moves at the national level to swing that pendulum back, to have stricter regulation? I mean, in a sense, some people recognize it has to be done just to save the planet, but maybe that's not even enough.
So my main field is in environmental and natural resource economics, and I've been teaching students about climate change since the early 1990s. There, it's a real question of the comforts and income of people living now versus the comforts and income of people living in the future. And politically, it seems like it's a very hard argument to win politically that we should sacrifice our present comfort for for the welfare of future generations. And one reason for that is if, for example, we were to say we're going to phase out the use of fossil fuels, that generally we wouldn't at the same time make any provisions for helping the people working in the fossil fuel industries when they're going to lose their jobs.
I suppose that could be included in legislation.
It could be. So in fact, if we think that, let's say, eliminating fossil fuel use is good for society, going back to the idea of Pareto efficiency, we might be able to do that in such a way that the pain is spread out, that perhaps everybody suffers, so it's not a Pareto improvement because it's not everybody getting better, but the pain is spread out so that people who lose their jobs would get income support. We tend, in the US at least, to structure public policies as if they're one side wins and the other side loses. So if the environmentalists win, then the fossil fuel people lose, and they lose all their income, and they just get they just have to fend for themselves. Or if the fossil fuel industry wins, then the environmentalists lose, and you have more or less unrestricted climate change. There are not a lot of situations where we try to craft public policy in a way to minimize the loss of the losers and the gains of the winners. And that sets us up for a whole lot of political conflict.
So we need win-win situations or outcomes.
And if not win-win, maybe sort of everybody loses a little bit. So everybody in the current generation, let's say, would lose a little bit so that people in the future generations wouldn't have to suffer so much.
In a way, I wonder if that's similar to the Franklin Roosevelt idea when he was trying to convince rich people that a rich guy who loses a little bit of money is still a very rich guy, that kind of thing.
Yes, and in fact, if you look at the attitude of, let's say, the captains of industry in the 1950s, where the distribution of income in the United States was much more equal than it was earlier or later, they seem to be more or less okay with it. So there have been times when it was more or less understood that sometimes it's okay to lose a little bit of, let's say, your income. Maybe, in fact, it was a good idea if it makes society more stable, if it increases social harmony, if it decreases things like income inequality. So yes, I think Roosevelt had the right idea, and he was able, as you said, he was able to convince the rich people that maybe actually it would be a good idea to compromise a little.
Not all of them, but yeah.
Not all of them. No, there certainly. I mean, you had the beginnings of the John Birch Society in during the Roosevelt administration, so certainly not all of them were convinced.
Anything else you want to add about efficiency and deregulation?
Well, I think that if we realize that we're being tricked into taking the business person's point of view that decreasing business costs is always a good thing, and we can escape from that mindset, that opens up the possibility for a much broader assessment of mergers, of regulatory activity, where we take into account not just what's good for the business person, but what's good for everybody who's involved, workers, consumers, but sometimes even neighbors of the firms, the local communities that are affected by firm decisions, especially firm shutdown decisions, to really cast a wide net and capture and think about all the different people that are affected by these kinds of economic activities.
That sounds like a great idea. There's so many great ideas kind of on the margins that are rejected by our leaders for some reason.
It's not a simple idea. It doesn't make the question of whether two firms should merge a simple question. In fact, it makes it a deeper and much more complicated question. But I think sometimes the easy answers aren't the right answers.
Although they play well politically.
They do.
That was University of Utah Associate Professor Gabriel Lozada speaking with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg about a new paper in the Institute for New Economic Thinking. It's called The Horizontal Merger Efficiency Fallacy. You've been listening to KBOO News In Depth. Thanks for being with us.
KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Here at KBOO, we honor the indigenous people whose traditional and ancestral homelands we stand on. The Multnomah, Kathlamet, Clackamas, Tomwater, Wet'lala Bands of the Chinook, the Tualatin Kalapuya, and many other indigenous tribes and nations of the region of the Willamette River and that great river known as Shuaneku, Wimal, Nishaiwana, and Columbia. Many names for the living water force that has sustained this region for countless generations and provided phenomenal life to our blessed ecosystems. We believe it is important to acknowledge the ancestors of this land and to recognize that we are here because of the sacrifices